I am Anjali Grantham. I'm sitting here with Bob and Sylvia Mativier in Birch Bay, Washington, at their home. This is August 8th, 2018, and this interview is being recorded as part of the NN Cannery History Project. My name is Anjali Grantham, and I have the joy of spending time with these two folks today to talk about their time at South Naknek and their experiences as cannery workers. Bob, could you begin by introducing yourself and telling me your name and where you're from, your birthday?
I'm Bob Mativier, born July 3rd, 1927.
Where were you born?
Blaine.
And how is it that you got into the fishing industry?
Well, where I was born and raised, I looked right across at the cannery, across the, so it's always been part of where I'm, the industry. And when I got involved working, first year I worked in Alaska, I went to Copper River Packing Company in Prince William Sound for Joe Most. Worked 1 year there.
What year was that?
1944.
And before then, what was your involvement with the fishing industry or with boating?
Well, no, it was just kind of when I started after school there. I started there from school. And basically, that was about it. Just watching, just being around with them. And I took it when I worked for the Alaska Packers in 1945. And I worked in the shipyard.
And where was the shipyard?
Right there in Semiamo. You see the water tank there? Well, they're right there.
Okay. Could you tell me, when you were just beginning as a shipwright, who taught you how to work on the boats, and what were some of the important lessons that they taught you?
Well, who taught me? Foreman's name was Dar Dickerson. He was a shipyard foreman, carpenter foreman. And learned the basic trades right through from the beginning. And then the company had, it kind of seemed like it happened or just happened that each year I'd have, I was a helper to the shipwright they would bring in. One from Pearl Harbor and California, and I learned my trade right through with those people all the way the rest of my life. Basically, that's kind of the way you learn it. Learn everything from the bottom up. Handling it, launching boats, pauling boats, lifting, building them.
What were the boats that you were building and repairing here back in the 40s?
Well, the boats then when I first started, there were sailboats, 29-foot Bristol Bay sailboats that we built for Naknek in the Bristol Bay. The power scows, we had a fleet of power scows, repaired those, serviced them every, and they were on about a 4-year cycle, the fleet. And the tugboats, barges, flat barges. This is when everything was just single barges. You loaded everything from the barge out in the Bristol Bay to the ships. Salmon went that way too. In cases of salmon went, loaded at the cannery and took it right out to the ships. The Alaska's, I guess it was, the Alaska Steamship Company, I guess, was the ones we went up with, and we were up in the ship first year.
From Blaine?
From here.
So the
everything worked from here. This was our home port. We worked around this. The office she was at was our office then. We at the Naknek, it was they took care of us up there.
So would you be employed all winter long by APA in the shipyards?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, then shipyard and a carpenter. I was a carpenter too.
What were you working on as a carpenter as opposed to as a shipwright?
all of the buildings. They're all wooden buildings and all. Everything never come up. Buildings, roofs, whatever. Mm-hmm. Docks. Kind of nail it down to any one thing and just everything.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me, back in the 40s when you first started as a shipwright, were you building new boats for APA or were you mostly repairing boats that already were around?
Primarily repairing, but we built some boats new. Lots of skiffs for setting it. We used to build a 16-foot skiff a day. There's a model of it right there.
Oh. And what would you base these designs on? Were they just handed down over the years, or did you innovate, or could you tell about the design of the boats?
Well, each design was basically that, well, you put it, kind of just come out of your head, I guess, yes. Basically what required for the size boat and what it was task, power. So, kind of a hard situation to answer that one, because it's just about everything you see on it is what you were doing. On the boats, you start with a stack of boards, timbers, big timbers. That's why I have two worn-out shoulders. Smaller boards were 3x12s. From there on up to 6x12, heavy. Bigger the barge, the heavier the timbers.
Where would you get the wood?
Well, it was milled out and hauled in from around here.
So local, all yeah, came
pretty
from
much,
Washington?
Yeah, all fir, pretty near all fir. Oh, no, lots of oak and stuff, but that was shipped in from a number of yards and hauled it, had it.
What was the preferred boards and wood for making the Bristol Bay double-enders versus a skiff, for example?
Well, the first ones were Port Orford cedar, and then there were red cedar. Port Orford couldn't get it anymore. So that was the basic oak ribs and either red cedar or Port Orford planking.
And what was good about those types of woods for the construction that you were doing?
Well, they're stable, and it'll hold there from the drying. Once the wood is, one of those boards is seasoned, it holds it. It doesn't shrink and fall apart when they're stored. Strength of it and the weight. So that's basic. Basically, most of the fishing vessels were built in Douglas fir, red cedar.
Did you build seiners for the APA too?
No, repaired ones.
Okay. Where were the seiners being dispatched to? Were they mostly fishing locally, or would you build seiners for the Alaska fleet as well? Or
they didn't have seiners when I, the part, the way, Bristol Bay was all sailboats.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was sailed there. So everything we built, we used to build a sailboat every 4 days complete, 29 footers. And in fact, I've got a corner built for myself, rebuilt when we bought them years later.
Would you assign a new number for every new boat, or would you, if one kind of went sunk or was beyond repair, would you just make a new one and give it the old boat's number? How did the naming happen?
The numbers were either carved in or put on a plate in small boats. And the big boats are carved into the timber's main beam. And the outside names were carved into the, around the hull. One of the bigger boats of their port, their sailing port, which is Alaska Packers, San Francisco. Had one of the Penguin of San Francisco. One of Pipit of Seattle, that was the primary boats for here in Blaine. In Alaska, we had the Tugs, and there were the Quail, and the Brant, and the Curlew, and the Raven, and a big fleet of them, too. And those we maintained. And they had a, we had a shipyard at Diamond J, Quijac, were a bigger ways. We could haul those boats there and work on them. We flew back and forth then to the, from Naknek over to there to stay there for a week, whatever we needed, and go back. Mm-hmm. Brought our cook and everything out, because that cannery was closed then. First year I went up, I was, Quijac was operating. That was the last year for that. Nice place.
And that was 1945, you said?
Oh, that would have been later than that. That's clear up into the, probably 60.
Okay. So, for the boats that you were building and repairing, what did it take for a boat to receive a name instead of just be assigned the Diamond NN number? Or, because I know that some of them were named, but many of them just had numbers assigned. Was it
all
based
the
on
larger,
size? Or?
All the larger ones were birds.
Okay.
And then the bigger and the barges, they were whales.
Ah, whales.
Sea lion, and the sea lion was a with an animal. Blackfish, orca, I have to remember all the names of them.
Hmm.
Brant, because that's a bird. They were either birds or whales.
Were the scows named?
No.
They were just given numbers then?
Just the flat scows. The ones that power scows were all named. They were vessels.
Okay.
They were power. Instead of being round like a hull, a regular hull, they were flat, barges. Got pictures of them. 24 by, I think the average on the 24 by 72 foot, the barges. And had a couple of larger ones, 105 footers. The Lois Anderson and the Bellina. That's the two biggest of the barges.
So were the barges, did they sometimes have bird names and sometimes have whale names, or how were they usually named?
You know, the last two big ones, they'd been military. Mm-hmm. And after the war was over with, then they inherited those boat vessels.
Mm-hmm.
So those were named the Bellina, that's a whale. The Lois Anderson married that to some pretty girl, I guess, I don't know.
So did you store all of the wood on site here in Semiyamu
yes.
to season it and everything? Or
yes.
Okay. So did you just have large warehouses full of timber?
A lumber shed, a big open shed,
mm.
right by the office building there, which is not anymore. That's by the water tower, too. That water tower is kind of the central spot for locating.
How many board feet do you think you would go through in a year here in Semiyamu for the building and the repairing of the vessels?
Boy, depending on the vessel you were on, probably 100,000 board feet all over with everything,
mm-hmm.
with the barges and all, something like that. A lot of boards.
Mm-hmm.
Timbers.
And, yeah.
Not boards, timbers.
So, because you cut them once they arrived, huh?
They were cut. Then you cut what you wanted out of them, yes.
Mm-hmm. What would you ship to Alaska? Would you ship the timbers or would you ship the boards?
Well, both. They had lumber. Each week, when we get Naknek, we'd have it. Well, boards for the dock and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And boat lumber to sit in its sizes you needed. And order of each size. And when they were all sailboats, a lot of this planking lumber.
Mm-hmm.
1 inch mostly like that for boats. An inch and a half. About it. They had everything. 2x4. All the lumber you'd need to rebuild the cannery. Because you rebuild a lot of it every year.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty rough weather up there. So,
what was the preferred building material then for the cannery?
What was the building material?
Yeah.
Well, all the canneries then were corrugated iron outside and fir timbers. The main basic buildings were 6x12s, some of them up to 60 feet long. Pretty, a lot of board. And then the 3x12 dock planking. Used lots of that. A few hundred thousand feet. Every few years it get broken up. And then piling for the docks. Timbers for the docks. That was all imported. That's how the barges leave Blaine here loaded with the lumber for there. Hauled most of our equipment up.
Would that be on the same shipment that the boats would head north as well?
Yes.
Or would there be many barges going back and forth?
Loaded and take it right north. And they'd bring the boats to be repaired back down, loaded for bringing down for repair machinery and everything else that way.
How would you decide if it was a repair job that you could do on-site in South Naknek compared to something that had to come down here?
Well, basically what it would require, yeah, for time and the material, well, the material you could get, but you decided for what the boss said. That was almost always done from up above, some from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So, did what you were told, in other words.
So, Semiahmoo was the place where all the boats and everything went up to Bristol Bay, but San Francisco was still the corporate headquarters
Oh, yes.
At that time.
Yep.
Mm. When did that end? When do you know when San Francisco closed down? I don't know.
I don't know when did it close down? Del Monte Corporation is what you're talking about. It's what and they're still in business, but it's a different company.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
R.J. Reynolds Tobacco bought them out. And I'm still getting a check from them. Retirement.
Hmm.
So, dates I couldn't tell you.
Hmm. Okay, we're back. So, you mentioned all of the different boats that you were building. What was your preferred boat building project? What did you like to do more than other tasks as far as repair or building?
Well, my major job was, most of the time, when something came in, had a planking job that I was always the head planker, did the planking, repair, replace. What was one of my primary skills. And then after that, when I took it over, it's everything. So, just get it fixed and get back into it. Everything was on a schedule. How much money was there to do it? Just like the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
How you'd explain it any more than that.
Could you describe the process of building one of the double enders, the sailboats, from the ground up?
Sure. You make a stem and a stern post. And a 3x10 single iron bark plank. That was the center piece of the keel. That was had a slot cut in it for the center board. They were sailboats. And basically that all. You set the stem up and the stern post up, the knee to hold them, and we made a jig for all of it that lay on upside down, and with it had the mold for the frames and bent the ribs all over that. That's them. Called clamp strakes in to hold them, then start planking. And the bottom, the keel down, and the bottom shear up. Garbage plank and shear planks, and from then on down. We went with about 16 planks up on each side, and then a shutter plank. You finished. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it was done.
And what was required to finish out the boat?
Well, they had we rolled them back up, put them up to upper. Well, they were sanded out, and caulked, all caulked tight. Then they were rolled over upright and clamped, clamp strake, they call it, with a piece around the edge all the way around. They call it a shear. The deck, and there's no decks on them. They just had a cover board around the edges and a small deck on the bow where they actually used to sleep under these short. And the mast step, that they were that step, the mast all laid down and you pick them up into the step. Rudders dropped in over the stern. It was made of wooden oak rudders. You stand.
Did you paint them as well?
Pardon?
Did you paint them here in Semiyamu?
Oh, yeah, I finished boats. When they were done here, they left them.
And what color would you paint them?
Well, knacknacks were white. Diamond, Clark's Point, they were, I think, they all had their numbers painted on them, too. NN or whatever cannery. Knacknack was NN. Diamond J was Diamond J, yeah. Clark's Point. Did you get to Clark's Point?
Mm-mm.
That's nice. I guess that's about it. That was a finished boat, painted up, away she went. Five days it was done and gone.
What was the most common repair that you would do?
Broken planking. Yeah. Hit and bash and planking. And main thing would be broken rib or two. And then as they age, the deterioration, they'd have to replace. But some of them were quite old. They got started out with I don't know what year they started, but some of them got to be quite, like, I was there a long time myself, so watched them age out. I was, I don't know, 30 years there, I think. 30-some years. So. That was about, pardon?
Oh, go on.
No, that's it.
I was going to ask if you heard anything about the original designers or those who came up with the design for the double ender or for the gillnet skiff or any of these boats that were used up there.
The original boats were, they called them Columbia River, where they started there and sailing and fishing in the Columbia River. That's basically what they were designed, and then pretty much the same design. The length had to be right on, it couldn't be any longer. That was the legal length and size. 9 by 29. That's 9 foot wide, 29 feet long.
Were there any design considerations for any of the boats that that you thought about in response to the conditions of fishing in Bristol Bay?
No, they were built, well, their centerboard, they pulled the centerboard up because of shallow water. You run in the mud, you're on the beach half the time. Basically, that's about the same design on everything. Had to be, because no power at all for the fishing. It becomes automatic. It's hard to even try to separate it.
Mm-hmm. How many people were working in the shipyard here in Blaine?
Well, at times we had about, 25, 30 men. Basically, two had a machine shop group, the power, all the engine, and then the carpenters.
And who was the foreman for the whole shipyard?
The superintendent, cannery superintendent.
Okay. Yeah. So there wasn't someone that was above the shipwright or above the machinist that,
no.
Aside from the superintendent?
Okay. Each one had their foreman.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so what is it that brought you from being in the shipyard in Semiyamu to Naknek? How did you get up there?
How did I get there?
Yeah.
Well, they asked me to go several years ahead of that time when I was working there. And I just basically said, a foreman? Oh, no, we just need a... No, and I said, I'm not interested. I'll stay right here. The second year, they made it worth my time. And I stayed there ever since.
And what year was that?
What did I go to Natick? 68. 68? Yeah.
And so from 68 until 1996.
Yes.
So. That's a good tenure. And so you went up to be beach gang boss or for some other job?
Ship, a carpenter foreman, the boss.
Okay.
Beach gang was kind of underneath them with work. They basically moved equipment, beach gang, and then unloaded fish.
Okay, so your job then was carpenter foreman.
Then later I became outside foreman over all of it.
Could you tell me what were the responsibilities of the carpenter foreman at the cannery?
The carpenter foreman? All of the dock work, all of the building, everything that needed to be done, the housing, through the bunkhouses, through the cannery buildings, office building, walkways. That was quite consuming. You see the size of the place. That's about it. And then in coordination with electricians and the plumbers, that part of it, yeah.
And what was the responsibility of the outside foreman?
Ooh. I had a list of that. I filled two pages. It was kind of overwhelming. It was just about water supply, unloading the fish and unloading and all that, handling the boats, loading the boats, doing all the carpenter work, road work, dock work, everything needed to be done in the carpenters or the boat mechanics, called port engineers. They weren't in the fishing canning operation. We were just out of the cannery buildings. From there on out was mine.
I see. So the outside foreman was in charge of the beach gang, the carpenters, the mechanics,
yes,
the shipwrights,
yes,
and electricians.
Basically, yeah, electrician was both ways. So you would.
Okay.
And the power and a powerhouse man and boiler man. They were kind of a dual purpose. They worked for each of us.
And so then you reported directly to the superintendent.
Right.
As the outside foreman. And when you were the carpenter foreman, you would have reported to the outside foreman.
Didn't have an outside foreman.
Ah, okay.
We just foreman, basic foreman.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't working that great. When I went there, we were having trouble coordinating. Everybody was against everybody. Mm. Kind of how it evolved. They just shortened it down to one man and the rest of them did what they were told. Very smooth operation. It wasn't the problem. Wasn't anything that was ever argued about. You didn't step out of line. You did what you were told. Didn't have time to do any. You basically had so many hours to do all this thing and start in the cannery from nothing in the spring to close it up when you left.
When did you become the outside foreman?
Tom Takioka was the superintendent then. I'm not too sure. Just kind of evolved or just kind of... I don't know. Do you know when Takioka was... Before Gary Johnson.
Gary was 76, I think probably 71. Probably.
About then.
71, must be. It kind of worked into that position, more or less.
Yeah, they kind of just worked it around. You were basically all the time. But then they put the titles on them.
So tell me about when you first arrived in 1968 at South Natick. What were your impressions of the cannery?
I want to get in an airplane and go home. first impression, oh God, so it looked pretty sick. It hadn't had any maintenance to speak of, and the buildings were all paint, all red roofs that were gone of color, and docks were bad, and it wasn't running very well. Everybody was on, and lots of alcohol, which ended when I got there. That didn't make me very popular at times. So, dangerous place. So you have to be on foot on everything. There's so many places you get hurt and killed it, and off the end of the dock, you know, it's just, you fall overboard there, you're gone. That's all, there's no coming up. Sandy in the water, you don't come up and swim.
So. What other dangers were there?
Just about everything you can think of. Yeah, well, basically, I guess that's a man. Equipment. But that was pretty well taken care of. Forklift drivers. Not too much. Carpenters get cut and things like that. And do what they're told and they don't have any problem. One fellow I was on, he got a big wide jointer and he was making a little board. And I walked over and I says, you don't do that. I'll have you know that I was doing this before you ever, just a pup. I says, not from now on, don't do it. And he went the next day, he did it, and he cut off four fingers. And he was a tennis player. Yeah, he apologized. I said, well, I tried to tell you. Big machine ate up a board and threw it at him and tore his fingers off. So that's kind of what the job was.
So what was your first main task when you arrived at South Neck Neck?
First main task? Well, I guess first main task was just getting, we were the first people, there were only four of us, went in, two of the cannery foreman and myself, superintendent, the cook. So it was just getting all of the mess hall and that going, operations. And the boiler room man came coming, and powerhouse man, that was it. Start with, until the crew started arriving in, a week or so later as he came along. Basically, when you started out, you were just a few people. Started from like the abandoned place to a cannery. When you left it the same way, abandoned, put away, except for the winter crew, the visitor, the ones that lived there. Carville Zimmon, he was the winter man. You know what it was. This evolved from then on up to whatever you had to do. Whatever came up, it was never the same project every day. So, get her done and get her down the next one. Go to bed at 11 o'clock and get up at 6. That was a regular day. Then you worked over lots of hours.
So when you would arrive, what month would you get up there usually?
The 1st of May, I guess the first years. They increased it. Later years, they changed the hours. But it took longer to get organized at first, get it all. But things got become more modern, power more and everything.
In the first years, you flew up then instead of taking your barge. And would the material that you'd shipped be there waiting for you, or would that come
basically
later?
What was left over from the year.
Okay.
They always had enough to carry you through. To the spring again, which you didn't, you know, I had a lot of repair work to do. Everything was just about there. Then a lot of it was shipped in. The barges got there, our barges got there just about the same time we did. So it was scheduled just about right with it, unloading and putting everything away. And the warehouses were jammed with stored with boats to start moving boats out of the way for freight. Get that all done.
So the boats were stored in warehouses instead of on the waves?
Yeah, the small boats, the fishing boats. the big boats were put at Diamond O down the river from the cannery, and then one at Diamond J.
So large boats were not stored at Naknek?
No. No, we didn't have any ways there. The early years there was, but they got rid of it. Mm. Diamond O handled, what, I don't remember, 12 barges, something like that.
How did you get the barges off of the ways?
They're all roll wheels, slide, called butter boards, timbers and planks that are oil greased, and then the ways are all wheels, railroad wheels. Pull them up the way you want them, and slide them sideways. And I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of it. That's they call it bents. They bring the river. The banks are that high, so each bring them up a layer for that one, and up another layer. Steam winch, pull them up. It's just so basically boring after a while.
And you said the water supply was 5 miles away. What would it take?
Well, that was the main power. That was the main cannery power water. That had a 14-inch wooden pipe. It was not the right thing to have there. And after we get into operation for the first 5 or 6 or 7 years, every time you get into production, somebody would shut some valves off quick. And it blew a big section of the pipeline out. That shocked me. Finally, I told him myself, I said, I'm not coming back next year. I can't keep the thing going there with what you got. The next week, there was a San Francisco engineer up there. What do you need? So he measured it all out, and he sent an aluminum pipe, 10-inch aluminum pipe, 5,000 feet of it. We laid that, and it's still, I guess it's still there. It was a small chore, too.
It was above ground, or was it buried?
Okay. Well, at first they buried it. Well, then it never thaw. It froze so deep that all that pipe was frozen. It's a learning thing there for them, too. I don't know how they buried it. I don't know how they put the wooden pipe in. It was wooden, wrapped with wire, pipe like that. They just break the water and break a section right out of it. As it got older, I don't know how old it was, but that's how that evolved. It was me or you. I'm not. You can't live through this and do it. So try as much as you could. You can't keep up. Well, it shuts the cannery down. We're in operation. I said, we do the best we can. You're so far lucky you got it. Go 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and get a crew out to get up. And it's 2 miles back. You walk most of it. So.
Did it come from, the water come from a lake or from a stream?
Yes, there's a lake there. We got pictures of the lake.
What's the name of the lake? Was there a name?
Blue Lake, I think it was called.
Blue?
Shallow lake. It was quite a pretty nice place. The land up there is so flat, and as over it evolved, the time ice would push the edges up, push and make a lake. The whole country up there is lakes. Well, this was a pretty good sized one. It was a good supply of water. 90 pounds of pressure at the cannery, so.
And the water then was how did it generate power?
Well, then we had diesel generators. Yeah, it wasn't used as power.
Oh, it wasn't. It was used.
Well, it was used made steam for the boilers. Yeah, and basically it was for the water and for canning. Can requires a lot of water. Hose everything's got water running. Mm-hmm. And as you shut down at night with a crew that's tired. They all run and get to bed, and they'll slam a valve shut. Well, 3 or 4 of them happened, and you stopped 4,000 feet of water coming. It's a lot of tons. Break it right up. Mm.
And so then you'd have to get up, find the source of where.
Right.
Where the
finding it was a project, yes. Mm-hmm. So, and
how would you repair the wooden pipe?
Well, we had sections we packed with us. Mm. 2 foot or 3 foot, and cut the wood right out, snap a new piece in, and then over the top. And clamps, made clamps, and clamped and put them over an over patch over the break. Usually it'd be one or two boards that were blown out of it.
How did you build and rebuild and design the dock based on the fact that the tides are always coming in and out and the ice problems? How did you do that and design based on the location of the cannery?
That was before me. It was all the design. We just followed it through. The tides, well, the ice would hang on and just hang there quite a while into the season, but it, I think about 24 foot from the bottom of the dock to the water, to the bottom of the river, tide, shore. But that, it pretty well maintained itself. Except when the ice would come down the river and break chunks out of it, big, big chunks of ice, like this house, 8 foot deep, thick, like that. All the canneries were the same up there, that big tides. Two tides like that a day, 20, well, up to 22 foot tide, so.
What was the process for repairing the dock if it had been damaged by a big chunk of ice?
Just chop a piece out, put more in, new one. Yeah, just break them up, yeah, put new timbers in, new piling. And that also broke all half the windows in the cannery when the ice had hit the dock and the cannery had all these windows. And that would break, well, the windows were 14 by 16, I think. And just to vibrate in the building to break a few hundred of those every year.
Oh my. So did you have panes of glass and then you would?
Oh yeah, cases of it. Mm. It was basically main to everything that could be replaced right on, out of the box and putty, I mean.
Wow, so you were a window glazer as well.
Everything. And then they had birds that came in the winter and picked half of the glazing out. What they call the camp robbers? I think it was. There was nothing in it. They'd pick, go ahead and pick, and then glass would fall out. Steel frames in the windows.
And where did you live in the cannery?
Well, at first we had a foreman. There was two foremen, cannery foreman, and myself, the carpenter, and then the cook, the main cook. We had a room right down by our little bunkhouse, right down near the mess hall. Then later, when Sylvia came, we got a house up on the hill that had been reserved for the diplomats from the California. So.
Was that right next to the White House?
No, that was up on top of the hill.
Okay.
Other side of the cannery. White House down below on a cannery level, and so it was up top level. Mm.
I see. Was that on the same hill that the Chinese cemetery?
Yep, just a little ways from the cemetery.
Mm. When I went there, the alders had overgrown, and so I couldn't really see the cemetery. Back in 1968, were there many people buried there and many graves, or
yes,
just a handful?
Quite a few. They had a, I don't remember what year, there was a Chinese diplomat came up, and he saw that neglect, and they had to get busy and straighten it all out again and clean it up. But there was quite a few people there. Then that below that, over back by the mess hall, there was called Chinatown, the little buildings that they all lived, Chinese crew lived.
What were they used for when you arrived?
Which was that? They always just stored parts. Mm-hmm. Says that everything changed, the crews changed. There must have been a lot of people at first, hand labor, everything.
Were there only Chinese people that were buried in the Chinese cemetery, or were there other canneries over there?
I don't know. I think it was mostly Chinese.
Did anyone, I'm sure by the time that you were there, when someone was injured or died, they were buried, they would be shipped back to their home instead of buried.
Oh, yes,
in
yes. Mm-hmm. Only, I don't know of any local, or any outside crew that was buried there. I know a lot of people that were buried there, but that's quite a process, too, when it's frozen, so.
Those Chinamen were ones that came up on the steamers from California.
Yes. Come up on the sailing ships.
The sailing ships. You saw that picture.
See, that's the only transportation there.
They were never sent back. They were just buried there.
Hmm. It was only way out.
Did you hear about any of the bodies being removed over the years?
No. I never have. They'd tell me, and I don't know if this is a... They said they used to salt bodies down in barrels that were shipped back to China, I guess. But that's more of just a rumor. I never heard, saw it, but they had to have done something with them.
Mm. Were you a member of a carpenters union?
Yep. Always have, still am.
And what is the union?
United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners. It's,
were all of the carpenters affiliated with APA a part of the same carpenter union, or... How did that contract negotiation work?
Well, carpenters were carpenters, and the other were machinists. Mechanics were machinist union. But everybody was pretty well covered with contract, union contracts, which is never a problem. So, you know, I don't know that any cannery workers had their own unions, which I stayed away from it, so I didn't. Involved with any of that. Three or four carpenters, machinists were primarily the union operating people.
And was the union headquartered in Seattle?
Probably was, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I belonged to the union here in Bellingham, and then we were a branch affiliated with the Marine Carpenters. And I stayed with that all my life. And I started, it was a must have had to when you started it.
It was required to be a member of the union to work for the cannery.
Well, it was required to be a worker in a job, yeah, through not by the companies, but. And it was a good idea. It was a good idea. People complained, but the ones that did it all profited. So I could never understand why there was be a problem. Nobody wanted to be told anything. Politics.
What? Where would you eat? Were you in the blue room or the white? With the
blue room.
Okay. Who ate in the blue room?
The office staff, some of the office staff, bookkeeper, radio operator, superintendent, cannery foreman, which was then the beach boss and myself. That was it.
Do you know why that there was a separate dining area for the foreman?
That's where we were, with the foreman. Mm-hmm. Then the rest of them were the mechanics, and then they all ate in a gray room. That was a different from the crew outside, from the cannery crew.
The mechanics ate in the, you said gray room?
Mechanics and the carpenters, yes.
Okay. So there was the blue room, the gray room,
yes.
And then the general mess hall?
General mess.
And was the general mess hall for both fishermen, white people, and the Filipino crew?
No, Filipinos had a complete separate quarters and mess.
And were they connected back in when you first started, or were they...
No, it was always that way, I guess. contracted Filipinos laborers, and Oriental, I guess, mostly Filipino. Mm-hmm. I mean, the carpenters and the machinists, mechanics, they all ate together.
Where did the fishermen eat?
Fishermen ate, well, I guess, in a general mess, didn't they? Yeah. Well, no, not the general. They in the general mess. So that was the main mess, all part of the home.
And when did your day begin? And did it begin with breakfast in the mess hall, or with work before you started eating, or what was the day in the life?
Well, basically, just like everybody else, it started at 8 o'clock, and we ate at the mess hall. And our three meals a day would be in the general mess hall. The mug up, you'd call it. They had that room. Everybody would go with that one, mixed. I guess then the days and meal times would be regular schedules, but as you worked, it's when you could get there. So onward to 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. Start back again at 6. So quite a long day. And under full production. The production stop and go back to normal.
What would you prioritize, knowing that there are so many things that could happen over the day and you were pulled in so many directions? What were the most critical things to keep going?
Your heart. water and power as the main things. From then to that, you work, branch out from that. And as things are required, but the basic things was water and power, electricity. Without that, nothing ran. The powerhouse man and the boiler man and myself and the water. Water was one of my main projects, always. We had filters to change it.
So were you then responsible for the pipes that would then pump the gurry out and all of that as well?
Well, it went right through the can, right down into a grinder and ran overboard. So, no, I wouldn't have to touch that. We had sluice ways down through in the cannery that all of the parts would go right through and ground up and go over into the river. Pretty well ground up, small. Huge grinder. One of my worries was just somebody disappeared if they went through the grinder. But that was down under the floors.
What were some of the main changes to the cannery complex itself that you noticed or that you took part in over the years?
Well, one of the main things was we changed the fish house. Fiberglass it all out, but fiberglass made them into, they were wood and it made fiberglass at all. Walkways, all the fish was brought up and sluiced in with water to the conveyor and right into each of the bins. Air compressors, blowing air into bins later that would keep the chill ice, keep them down, cool. That's one of the main, moving the fish with water, basically. Flumes instead of having to belt.
When did that happen?
Probably the last 10 years of the cannery operation.
So did they, before that, was it the whole belting system?
Pretty much, yes.
Okay. When did the fish house project happen?
The last time it happened. And when we completely redid it, took the whole floor out of it, everything out of it, Steve Jones went up with me. One of my other carpenter foremen, he went back to work for the aluminum plant. He went back up with me because he was my fiberglass man over here in Blaine. He ran the fiberglass operation. So I'm not sure the year of that. Probably 8-10 years before we shut down. Yeah.
Any other major projects as far as new bunkhouses or...
built a girl's bunkhouse for the cannery girls up on the top of the hill. One of the major ones for me. Let's see. I think this major keeping a thing together. And then changing the routing of the cans from the after they were canned and then cooling and moved and get it from there done and then back into the warehouse. And the system all changed pretty much after that. They started putting vacuum over the pallets of salmon. Changed that whole system from into, first they were put into wooden boxes, then later they went into cardboard boxes. And then it just kind of, in the first years they were four-wheel wagons and they towed them with a little power lift. Then they all went into pallets and forklifts, all shifted that way, much faster.
You said the vacuum. What do you mean by the vacuum?
What was that based on?
It was with the after they were cooled. You said something about a vacuum.
I don't remember. Cooling the cans, getting the air to move it away from out of the heat out of it, to chill it. They put a whole system in. That the floor was open underneath. The river was right below it. The air came up and cooled it. They tried to, later the year afterward, I told them it wouldn't work. No, yes, it will, and we can use that storage, but it didn't work. The pack would scorch, so you don't get cool. So.
What did they do?
I don't know, I left. I was gone. They got rid of some of the people that did it, I guess. I washed my hands of the whole thing. And I was developing a heart system. I had to have a heart valve job and that end of it.
So when you said that you rearranged the way that the movement, it sounds, of the cans and the facility, what did you change? Was it that you put different workstations in the buildings,
different,
how did that work?
Different belting system. We put in, can't remember what to call the big belts, the big wide belts, that conveyor belts with it. You could, all the fish and thing would go through. That was in the raw product. From the fish house after processed, after it was gone through and cut and cleaned and then to the cannery, into the canning machine. They changed all that. Changed a lot of the cannery machinery around, the way it was oriented. Changed my mind a lot of.
What prompted the change?
Speed. High-speed machinery required lots of faster movement, and the canning machines much faster and handled much more product at a given time. You had to move all of that. You had to cook it all and get it cooled, get it ready to go back in the warehouse. And we put an aerial overhead from the cannery can shop building clear to the warehouse. And everything was moved over top of that and then taken down into the warehouse. And there's your, then it can encased, or not cased, put into a pallet.
Oh. So like an aerial sort of like a walkway thing?
Yep, had a walkway and a conveyor across it.
So. Oh, so to go from the cannery or from the fish house into the cannery into the cooling shed?
From the fish house to the cannery up to the cans. See, the cans were all made too. Cans came, big pack of cans, and it was formed and made the cans. Then they went back down to the cannery, then they came back up and threw pallet to the pallets. After what it cooked, and then back up to the pallets. Missing an operation there. But basically it broke down a primary conveyors and forklifts fast, a lot faster equipment.
Did you have to make any changes to the cannery buildings after they started using the stackable can instead of the reformers?
Let me see. It gained a lot of room because it shortened. I mean, that was upstairs. Did you go to the plant at all?
Yes.
You saw where the lunch room was upstairs? Or the mug up room was?
Yes,
Well, right there, up there, that's the top. That level is where the cannering was, right down through the out to the powerhouse. So we redid that pretty well, opened it up so you could move through it. Seemed like just a long, steady one thing after another all the time. Had to repair the buildings are getting old and falling.
In your mind, what do you think are the oldest buildings on site?
Oh, I think that the cannery probably itself was the saltery. That was over 100 then. So in the carvings, in the beams and stuff. By the warehouses. I don't know what year it would have been, but a lot of age involved before I got there. Mm-hmm. Went from sailboat days, sailing ships days, to the sailboat days, to the powerboat days.
Could you tell me about the conversion? Were you involved in making the sailboats into powerboats?
Yep.
So what did the shipwrights think about that?
No, they didn't care. Just another project. Strip them out, cut the stern off, put up metal. We designed a piece that fit right in with the tail shaft and all the propeller stuff there and the rudder. Got that bolted in. That was the main part of it, and then put a metal cabin on them. Each one pretty well fit. They were pretty well uniform, so seemed like I'm kind of a rough to go into a boat and cut a chunk right out of the back end of it for this new apparent metal piece to fit into, but it worked. Converted a lot of boats.
How long would it take to convert one of the boats?
Well, probably 2 days, 3 days with a crew. I had a crew at Clark's Point doing it. I was a foreman there, Clark's Point, when we converted it. Had three plants that redid the Naknek, Clark's Point, Naknek, and Igigek, I guess, had a crew that went in. We went in from here as a crew to do that job, and then we left.
I see. So you didn't actually do it in Semiyamu. The conversions happened up in Bristol Bay?
Mainly. Mm. We did some here, but mostly up there.
How were the fishermen paired with boats?
I don't know. Depend on the favoritism of the fish boss, which is another whole regime itself. When I first were there, they were company men. Then later they become independent, so Sicilians. Our groups were primary Sicilian fishermen. Wonderful guys. Some of my best friends I ever had from the Sicilians. They were all great fishermen. But that's, and then they had their own boats. When they converted, when the sailboats went out and then the power came in, that didn't last only a few years. And they all converted to different style boats, bigger boats. Not really bigger, but bigger, more capacity. The length was the same. Somebody started the house up.
So the fish boss then was almost like another sort of foreman?
Yeah, just with the fishermen. I know they were, I don't understand their whole work, but I didn't, you know, I stayed clear of all that. Just did what they needed done. We'd do their work for them and sign a contract when you'd have some work done, and they'd do it and get them out and get the next boat. There'd be always a lineup with repairs. They get injured out in the picking on the fishing gun when they're unloading and banged around. Then the boats went to fiberglass for a little bit, then they went to aluminum, and that changed the whole. Took most shipwright out of it, the woods. They were wooden boats pretty well phased out the time I left. Phased into aluminum and some fiberglass, but the fiberglass couldn't stand the abuse of the metal boats beating against it. It's stronger, but it's weaker, so.
So you would spend most of your time, if you weren't out and about, in the carpenter shop. And did the boats that you repair, did you repair them on the beach, or would you?
No, into the warehouse.
Okay, so you'd,
we had a big door right in the warehouse, right to the carpenter shop.
Okay, and you had a crane there that could lift them?
No, put them on wheels. They lifted them off the dock on the hoist, set them on the cart, and then roll them in.
That's a big cart.
Not too big. It's kind of a long channel iron with the wings on it and a heavy-duty roller, hard rubber rollers, wheels about that wide and that high. And they set on that, and then on each end, just swivel wheels.
So what do you think were, since we're doing this exhibit looking at cannery work, what are the most important tools or objects that come to mind for the outside foreman and the carpenters at NN? What are some good things to represent that sort of work? Worn shoes?
No, it wasn't that. It wasn't that cold. It was fairly dry. Tools, just basic hand tools. Welding equipment, saws, skill saws and band saws, kind of the basic of the whole thing, because each job was different. So, and the welders were portable, most of them, a lot of them. So we had our welders that were always, built a welding shop for them. They mostly did their own painting, so. We also had a building in the back, and it was a paint house. Every kind of a color you could think of in there. Everybody had a different choice for colors. The 50 different colors of gray, they all had a different choice. I guess basically that's just basic hand tools. Did require a lot of other equipment, a forklift to lift, move it around, and power, cords, drills. Still have the same thing in my own shop here, so.
Mm. And over the years, as different owners came on, how did your job change under new ownership?
It's pretty well basically stayed the same. They were going to change me out with the other earlier crews, and that's when San Francisco stepped in and said, no. And they leased me out and leased me back to the owner, to the last ones, people that took over for a few years. It's kind of how that it worked. My job stayed the same. Owners changed. Mm-hmm. They come around to my way of thinking. I don't know. What else could you do? Something that's been done for 100 years and somebody comes and wants to change it in a season, don't do it. You won't work it. Don't have time to do it. Go from a bare place to a busy place to a bare place in 3 months.
So what would it take at the end of the season to close it up for the winter?
Well, all the piping had to be drained. Yeah, all the belting had to be taken off. In the latter years, there weren't as much belts because they eliminated that. Individual motors on everything instead of belts, which was a big change. Just bring the boats in, clear out, stack everything, load the warehouse full of boats, storage. Everything on the winter storage, had winter places where it's all put in, pretty well dried out and went drained. Boats had to be drained and fueled up. Never put them in the way empty tanks. They sweat and full of moisture. Just basically lay out each boat. Each individual would hire a mechanic to winterize it, they called it. Antifreeze in it, and each one of them. As they went through the fleet, that about pretty well. All the barges that stayed, they had to go through and winterized, drained, dry. It sounds so simple.
Did you board up windows ever or anything
no.
like that? Okay.
Did for a while, and they found out that wasn't the thing to do because they sweat. And having it all dark, it would sweat, and then it would harder on the buildings. So we didn't board them up anymore. Another learning curve. Even the house we lived in up on the hill, they boarded everything up on it. It rot the thing right out, so changed all that. Let the sun get in. There's a lot of sunshine hits up there. Short season, but it's bright. It's quite bright country, dry.
So what do you think of the canneries, of the APA canneries and the canneries you've been to, what do you think makes South Naknek an exceptional or special cannery or place?
Well, the access to the place in the first place. Then the water supply that they don't use anymore because they don't use that much water was the main thing to put the plants where they're at. The plants were all built in gulches, all of the canneries, and the land around them is high up above them. So they had the creeks all came down from the tundra. Everything's surrounded by tundra. So they had a basically, where water would run, there'd be water running there somewhat. That's about it. I don't know what else.
And how long did the shipyard here at Semiyamu continue?
When did we shut down?
82.
Hmm?
82,
yeah.
That's when you came back.
Yeah.
82.
Last year we came out of Alaska. That,
yeah, I don't know. They might have, was it offering when you got back? I don't think so.
Did some work over here for another year or two, didn't they?
Was it?
Yeah. Did some private work for boats, other outfits. And yeah. We had the facilities to handle it. We did that.
Why did they shut down the shipyard?
Everybody wanted to move to Seattle. So like it. I don't know. I don't know what makes companies think.
And that's when they decided they were
going to
sell property.
Yeah, they sold everything. You're down there and see those nice new homes out there? One of those houses costs as much now as that whole piece of land. What they got. Shareholders kind of took it there, didn't they? So that land comes clear up over the back over here. As you come around, those wood trees back up there. Some of that was clear up to there.
They sold that for
That's how it was. And they walked away and left the machinery and everything just like it was. Walked away and left everything sitting. Kind of break your heart to see some of that.
Well, that was, I think, a pretty bad year. I'm thinking that might have been about the time of the botulism outbreak.
Well,
wasn't that in like 82 or something around there, 83?
Could, I don't know about that part. But it had gone, evolved that way over the years as the salmon would. Not every year was a good salmon year. Some they had some pretty good long dry spells. So that would leave it just left alone, abandoned in that climate and that weather. You start over again and have to do half of it over again. So it's an expensive operation. But it was a lot of fish, Kent. So the largest run of salmon in the world, I guess.
Over Bristol Bay. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard how much they did this year?
It was a very good year, I
know. Was it?
Yeah, it was not record breaking, but one of the best years in a long time, especially with Nooshigak.
Okay, that was, yeah, because some of my friends, one of my fellows that took my job over still works up there, so he works at Nelbro over across there. Mm. Not Nelbro, but Sea Alaska. Is that not Sea Alaska? What is it?
Maybe Icicle?
No, the one that's there right now. Bundrum owns it. What's the name of the company?
Trident?
Trident Seafood, yes. See, nobody think of it either.
Yeah,
Trident. Still has an operation across the river. Mm-hmm. They own both sides. They had it all.
Well, that's where we stayed, of course, but I stayed one night at South Naknek, but we didn't actually go to the Trident Cannery in Naknek.
They do mainly, I don't think they do canning there. I think it's all processors, frozen fish.
Mm. They might, because Randy Johnson, he's still working as the foreman, and I think that they're canning.
Probably are.
Bristol Bay is like one of the main places still for canning in Alaska, just because there's such production in such a short period. You know,
yeah.
It's like,
yes.
Well, they must have started canning after they quit there at South Naknek.
Mm-hmm.
They used to. They weren't a cannery.
Were they canning through the whole time that you both worked there at South Naknek?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
One year we didn't. Just canned.
That's right.
Just candy, you could get canned, and Naknek didn't.
Was the year that we stayed home, I remember.
There, it didn't operate at all at 74?
No,
that has a fish camp.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maintained the fleet, but the canning.
We didn't do any canning.
And so, no processing at all then in 74?
No.
No. All the freight and stuff came through there mostly, but fish camp, and fishermen stayed. The bunkhouses were open, a lot of them. And
mm-hmm. Bob, is there anything else that you'd like to say before I turn over to Sylvia?
No, I've said more than I can remember now. I'm 91 years old, by the way, so it might sound like cheating a little.
I'm amazed all that you can remember.
Yeah, I was going to say, you did well.
Yeah.
I can remember.
Here, Sylvia, I'm going to move this a bit closer to you.
Here, she can sit here.
Sylvia, could you please talk a bit about where you're from and your young life and any influence that maybe brought you to become into the world of the fishing industry and cannery work?
Well, I'm from North Dakota. Dickinson, and my folks moved to Seattle when I was 3, and so I went to all the Seattle schools, and then my folks built a resort at Birch Bay, and that's how I ended up in Birch Bay. And I did go to school a year and a half
I actually graduated from Blaine. And then after I graduated, I went to Seattle and I worked for Link Belt Company for at least a year. And at that time, my sister was working at the employment office in Bellingham, and there was a job that came available in Blaine at Alaska Packers. So I took the bus up and was interviewed, and he wanted me to start right away. So I had to go back and tell him that I would like to not be employed anymore, and that's how I ended up Alaska Packers. And that was in February the 20th, 1951. And then I worked all that time until 1996 between Blaine and Naknek. Actually, I didn't start working at Naknek seasonally until 1976. And then I would come back to Blaine and then work all the winter months.
So what were you hired to be back in 51?
I was hired to be more or less a bookkeeper type thing. That's kind of the jobs that I had. Different jobs. There were six of us in the office, and there was a office manager, an assistant, and a timekeeper, and a warehouseman that took care of the information from the cannery. It was a cannery then, too. It was operating cannery. And so, basically, that was about how I started. And then, during the canning season, we had to work quite a little overtime because of the canning part. And so there was quite a bit of book work in that respect. And, you know, a lot of people were employed, and so there was payroll and the usual routines of an office.
And so you were responsible for the payroll part of the bookkeeping, or were you responsible for other types of bookkeeping?
Actually, other types, more or less, in the accounting part of it. Yeah, we had a regular fellow that was the actual bookkeeper.
So what sort of accounts would you take care of?
Oh, it was actually charges for the cannery, purchasing products for the cannery, and just the usual things.
So would you do orders for the cannery then?
Yeah, we'd help out with the orders, right. They'd have to order cans, and they'd have to order fiber boards, just about everything, you know, for an operation.
Who were the main vendors?
American Can is the one for the cans, and I think Fiberboard was the ones for the packaging, for the cartons and that sort of thing, as I recall. And then we had fishermen too, and so we always had a Pacific Marine and Seattle Marine. We'd buy supplies from them for the fishermen. And I'm not too sure how many fishermen we had. We had, how many fishermen did we have? I don't know. We had a lot of the Indian fishermen fished for us. They were very nice people. They were from Lummi.
How did that relationship between the APA and the Indian fishermen continue following the Bolt decision?
That was kind of a sad situation, wasn't it? Yeah. I don't think we were fishing then, were we, when that Bolt?
No.
During Reagan's, that was Reagan, wasn't it? That is the one that
did that
Bolt.
The thing that killed the salmon industry here was when they gave the fish and rights to the Canadians. It died.
Yeah.
Then on all of it.
So when you say we were fishing, are you talking about the Mativier family or Semiyamu APA?
APA.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So could you describe the relationship between Semiyamu and Naknek? was it that this was a place that everything would be outfitted? I'm trying to figure out. It seems that this was a nucleus sort of place for some sort of the operations up there, but I haven't quite figured that out.
Well, they used to buy purchase order things for the canneries, the various canneries. It wasn't just Naknek Cannery, it was all the cannery in Egigik and Clark's Point and that sort of thing. And they had retail stores in the canneries too, and so they had a department with retail stores, and they would order things for the stores that were at the various canneries. And that the natives, they loved that because they could purchase things right there on their homesteads.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so
that was something that they, later on they eliminated, but it was up there quite a while. They had the restores, which was retail stores, were nice. That the village people could come in and purchase different items, food, clothing. They usually have a nice selection. When I got up there at Naknek, they had quite a nice selection. Mm. And that was something else that was phased out later on.
When was that phased out?
Oh, gosh. It's hard to remember all these dates, you know. I guess it was probably phased out in the 80s. I would say in the 80s.
What's that?
And don't you think the retail stores were phased out in about the 80s?
Yeah, in late
70s. Yeah, late 70s, 80s, whatever, something like that. Yeah.
And did you then do ordering for the stores at all, or that was a different department outside?
Well, that was
of
a
the
department.
Office?
They had a special department for that.
Okay. And so how did your job change as the years went on?
Oh, gosh. It just seems like when you're in the bookkeeping, you get into an accounting, they just go from... For a while there, they were trying to get everybody to really feel and know the business, so you kind of go from one department to the other and work mm-hmm. there for a little while, which was nice. And so, but basically, it was in the bookkeeping accounting business mm-hmm. for what I did.
And what was the relationship between Semiyamu then and the San Francisco headquarters?
I didn't really know that much really about San Francisco. We had people that had worked in the Seattle office. Alaska Packers had a Seattle office. Mm-hmm. They closed that down, and those people came up to Blaine. And when they had that earthquake in Anchorage, those people came down to Blaine. And so we had quite a staff here in Blaine. The office staff was quite a few people, and we had that combination of everything. And then again, there you are. You have each department... have a department, you'd have Naknek, and you'd have Egigik, and you'd have, you know, you'd have an accountant, and you'd have a bookkeeper type thing for each place.
And who or where would the information at the end of the season go to? Was that all housed in, here in Semiyamu, or was that in San Francisco?
A lot of it was San Francisco, I think. Mm. Yeah. That was the main office. Then after they closed the one that was in Seattle and the one in Anchorage, mm-hmm. so then you'd have to. It was through San Francisco, yeah. The communication, mm-hmm. yeah.
And was it also San Francisco that did a lot of the hiring of the office people? Or?
No, that was always done on a local basis.
Okay.
They would come up, you know, and check things out and kind of try to tell us they wanted different things to be changed and that sort of thing. But other than that, they were just kind of run by themselves here in Blaine.
And was it mostly women that worked in the office, or was it
combination?
Okay.
Yeah, very much so. Mm. Yeah. Because you had the men, you know, you'd have the superintendent, and you'd have his accountant, and maybe the assistant superintendent for each station, each Alaska station. And so there were a lot of men, as you can tell, yeah. So, and then they had a gig out into the computer system down the road, and that, you know, that was enlightening, of course. So, anyway.
How many people were working at the Semiahmoo cannery?
Oh, boy. Oh, dear. I'm not too sure how many were working. Maybe you would know. Would you know how many worked at the
cannery? Depending on the size of the run of fish.
Yeah, that's true.
They go up to probably 100 people and then down to...
Yeah, and go down to maybe
30 or...
Yeah, depending, like I say, the run.
But what about just kind of like the office, like the year-round?
Oh, the office?
Mm-hmm.
That basically was about the same.
Mm.
And they'd go up in the spring, they'd go to Alaska. Mm. And so then we would just be here in Blaine. And we had the shipyard type thing. And, of course, they'd quit canning, so we didn't have a cannery here anymore.
Mm. So what is it that inspired you to start joining Bob in Naknek every year?
I don't know. I think he was kind of lonesome, probably, and then was just kind of.
I wouldn't have stayed.
Kind of an adventure for me, I think, and they asked me to go, and so actually, Gary Johnson was up there, and he was working as a bookkeeper, and then he got promoted, and I took his position up there, and so that's how it all started for me.
I see.
And he was the assistant superintendent, and then he became superintendent. And so actually I took his place up there as the bookkeeper.
And that was 1974.
And that would have been 76.
Oh, 76, okay.
Yeah, that
mm-hmm.
was about 76.
Okay, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And?
That's how it started.
And were you eager for the opportunity to go up there, or what?
Oh, yeah. I guess I had mixed emotions about it, but it was kind of an adventure, and I enjoyed it.
Had you been up before any summer to visit?
No.
Hmm.
No, I hadn't. Of course, he'd been there since 68, so I knew pretty much the situation, you know, so, yeah, so it probably would have been a shock to me if I hadn't known when you wanted to get up there.
How did you keep in touch over the summers when you were down here and Bob was up in Alaska?
Telephone.
Okay, so there was always a phone.
Yeah, it was telephone.
Mm, that's nice. So you weren't stuck to just letter writing?
No.
Mm.
Yeah, it was the phone and letter writing.
Were there multiple phone lines at the cannery?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. No, up there they had that.
The village had
telephone. Mm. And if you wanted to call out, you had to go up to the village and stand in line and call out. Now, did you have problems calling me, or you picked the right time to call?
My office always took me across the river. I was kind of spoiled.
Oh, that's right. You went across the river on the north side to call me, which was usually on a Sunday night, I think it was. And... So basically, and then you'd call. That's when I'd talk to you. Yeah, that's right.
So you'd have a weekly phone call.
It was kind of antiquated, wasn't it, when you said about the telephones up there.
Well, that's nice, because a lot of places, you know, a lot of people would wait in line for hours and hours and hours.
Oh, I know, because I know I used to want to call out or something, call home to my folks, and... you stand in line, you wait your turn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What year were you two married?
57.
Okay. And tell me about your first impressions when you arrived at NN.
I don't know. I guess my first impression, I think I got stuck and I missed the plane to Pen Air, I think it was. So I had overnight with my dog in a motel, and I had to go to the restaurant and then get food for the dog. And it was really interesting. I got up there to the airport, or up to, up to the airport, you know, and oh my gosh, I've never been there before. And I thought, oh gosh, and happened to run into one of the bosses from Alaska Packers. And so he was really good about helping me find this motel and that sort of thing. And so then I went out the next morning and went. So that was the first thing. And then lost my luggage, of course. You know how that goes in Alaska. So it was kind of a different, a different learning curve. Yeah.
Was your job different than it was in Semiyamu when you started at NACNEC?
Different things. Yeah, it was a different thing. But, you know, when you get into bookkeeping and accounting, you're out just for the business, you know, who it is. So, yeah, it was different.
What was different
Actually, I started out as an office manager.
Mm.
Yeah, so I was that for 4 years. And then they wanted to put somebody on year-round as an office manager for NACNEC.
Mm.
And it would be stationed in, he'd be stationed there in Bellevue. So then I just continued going as a accountant up there and not an office manager. And so I was just that until we retired.
Mm. So what was the office manager position? What was your responsibilities?
Oh, gosh. Well, you had to make sure everything went pretty good, you know. You had to overlook the timekeeper and the fish clerk and help out with the fishermen if they had any problems and just general office functions.
What did the timekeeper do?
They took the timekeeper took time for the employees in the cannery.
Was there a place to clock in and clock out? Is that
no?
How?
They picked up the time cards. Yeah, and some of the foremen down there in the cannery would bring the time cards up to the office, or the people in the office would go down. They had a certain area with it where they were,
and so
pick them up.
Would people write the time that they started at the beginning of the day on their time card?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the timekeeper would funnel the information to the payroll person.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm.
Yeah, you actually had two people. Yeah, you had a timekeeper and the payroll. Yeah.
Mm.
They worked together.
Were people paid over the course of the season, or just at the end of the season?
No, they were. The people were paid. They were paid monthly. At one time, we were paid on a weekly basis, and then they changed, I think, to a monthly, as I recall. Yeah.
So.
And you could draw on it. You could get an advance.
Mm-hmm.
If you needed money or something, then you could get a cash advance on your payroll. And there were a lot of people that did that.
So people would be paid in, they could choose to be paid in cash or check then?
It was all checks.
Where would people cash the checks? In NACNEC?
Oh, gosh. I don't really know. I think most of them sent them home, as I recall. I think if they got a cash advance, they'd have cash in their pocket. And I think most of them sent their checks home.
Okay.
If they were family,
mm-hmm.
yeah, they would just send them home.
Because I can imagine they're probably worse.
Yeah, because there's no banks there, per se, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There, I don't know if they had a grocery store up there, but I don't know if they actually cashed them up there. I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they had that much money up there. They had a little grocery. The natives had a little grocery store up
in
there.
In South NACNEC?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
That was, did the store at the cannery, would they cash checks, do you remember?
Oh, you mean the retail store
mm-hmm.
that they had? I don't think so, no.
Mm.
No, I don't think they did that. Mm.
Were people still using like mess hall tickets and cannery tokens by the time you got there?
No, they weren't. Did they used to do that? I wonder. I don't. Did they?
Yes.
That's before my time.
Yeah, I'll show you. In a moment, I'll show you. Sunny just gave me a book of tickets that was used for.
Oh, how interesting!
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, they didn't do that.
Mm. So, when someone was hired, then they would be hired knowing that they had a place to sleep and as much food as they wanted to eat over the course of the year.
Well, yeah, that's true. A lot of them enjoyed that. Well, you know, they're going through college. They're going, you know, the cannery workers, most of them are college kids. And so, you know, it was a good deal because they could save their money pretty much for college. Yeah, and they didn't have a lot of expenses.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good.
When you started, was it mostly college kids, or did you know kind of any changes?
When I started in the cannery, I think it's always been college, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you notice any kind of shifts in the workforce over the years that you worked there, in age or ratio of men to women or ethnicity?
When it changed over to the eggs.
Oh, that's right. We had the Japanese, didn't we? They had the egg house there, and the Japanese came. And there were quite a few of those guys that came. Those processors, weren't they? They overlooked all that egg business. Yeah, I don't know. There was always a mixture. We had a lot of fellas from California that came to the cannery, Filipinos. Yeah, they worked, you know, they were slimers and stuff. They were really good at that. So, in the cannery, it was just a combination of everybody between that and all those fishermen. When we quit, there was about 425 fishing boats that fished for us. And so you had a lot of fishermen. And you had all their deckhands and stuff. And we used to have to do the settlements and that sort of thing.
Wow.
And we used to have to record all their purchases when they went out. They went to the tenders and delivered. And they would pick up groceries and that sort of thing. And then the tenders would have to send in the copies of the bills and everything so we could charge them to the individuals. And that was quite a deal too for a while. So,
wow. So you would, when you were to do the settlements for the fishermen, that was always at the end of the season.
Oh, yes, right.
And so versus the cannery workers and staff, they would be paid over the course of the summer.
Oh, yeah, right.
So how, when you think about the average summer out at Knack Neck, how many people do you think you would end up paying?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I didn't.
This sounds like a lot.
Well, yeah, there was quite a few, you know, and I, cannery workers, I don't know how many people they needed in the cannery. Did you know about how many people were in the cannery? Then you had the mess hall. You had all the people in the mess hall.
Must have been about 10 people on a line, so.
10 people on a line, and you had how many lines were there?
30, probably 100 people in just the cannery operation.
Yeah, I suppose, in a round figure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mess hall people, gas man. Well, that was another thing. The boats would go out and purchase gas. It was stationed out in the water, and then you'd have that to charge to their accounts. So you had bills coming from all over to charge your account, so that was a big job. And fortunately, on computer by then, so yeah, you have to do that, a lot of that on hand, like you used to have to do with the ledgers, the old-time ledgers.
That would be a big job.
Yeah. Yeah, when you get that many fishermen. Yeah.
So who then worked in the office at Knack Neck?
Oh, let's see. Well, I had the receptionist and the office manager and the timekeeper and the fish clerk. And then you had a couple other ones that like filing and doing that kind of stuff, different jobs where they were needed. That's kind of basically what was in the office.
Was the superintendent also in the office?
Oh, yeah.
And would most of these people just work in Naknek, or were there many people like you who also worked for APA?
No, most of them. Well, let's see. Actually, I don't know. Actually, it depends. If they were in Bellevue, that there were a couple of them, like we had the office manager, worked in Bellevue. Of course, the superintendent worked in Bellevue, so it depended on what year it was. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the other people were just seasonal people.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, when you started back in 1951 with APA, what role did the cannery play in the community of Blaine?
Shut that up.
So we were talking about what role APA played in the Blaine community.
Well, it seemed like everybody in Blaine worked at one time in Alaska Packers. They worked in the cannery or they worked in the warehouse because they used to have the salmon. They shipped the salmon down here and warehoused it here.
There was 27 canneries in Blaine at one time.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's even more than in Bristol Bay.
Much more than Fraser River.
Yeah, I guess it was something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, when it came to Blaine, I think that was one of the biggest work places that there was. He would probably know more about that prior to me coming.
How about
Blaine?
But when it shut down, how did people feel about that?
Oh, I don't think they were too happy. You know, that was a job they had, and they enjoyed that job, and that was the end of it. Yeah, Blaine is not a place to really find jobs. You know, you have to go to Bellingham or someplace. Yeah.
What did you do after 82 when they sold Semiahmoo?
Well, I went to Alaska.
Okay, and so you...
That was just seasonal.
Okay.
I did, there was 2 years, I think it was 83, maybe 84, that I worked for Anvil, which was an engineering firm in Bellingham, and I worked 2 years there. Mm-hmm. Then I decided I'd go back. To Alaska, I guess it was in my blood.
Okay.
And so I resigned from that job. I was administration assistant there. And then I went back up seasonally, and then I was accountant there again.
Mm-hmm. So of the canneries that operated in Bristol Bay, what sort of reputation do you think APA had compared to the other canneries?
Number one.
Why is that?
Water. One was water. Some of them ran out of water, and I don't know. Nelbro across the river was probably number two. And what the rest of them had phasing out when I went there, they closing down a lot of them. Libby's and a lot of those places are gone. So, and Bumblebee, our PAF, had slowed right down.
So
were you ever tempted to work for any of the other outfits?
Every day. I don't, never. I like the company. They treated me.
Yeah, when you came home, it took about a month to get over all those long hours, you know. Oh, gosh. 7 days a week, you know, it's like being on a treadmill, you know, you can't get off of it. But when you look back, you think, well, it was pretty much of an experience, you know. Glad you had the experience.
So when would you take vacation if you worked in the winter for the company and then in the summer?
Well, when we got back from...
took 2 weeks off?
We would take about 2 weeks and go someplace, I guess. That was about our vacation, yeah.
And did any family ever visit you up there? Did you bring family with you?
No. No. No.
You can never tempt them north, huh?
I don't think they were interested. They had their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think is important for people to know about cannery work at Naknek and about the Alaska Packers Association?
Both of us, or just her?
Both of you.
Yeah. I think they were excellent. Between, I was always, I worked so long for the company, been in 60 years with them, so.
I enjoyed all of the people, and I also enjoyed all the village people, all the natives. Very nice people. Yeah, in fact, I miss those people when we, you know, retired, and we wouldn't see them. Otherwise, it was like a homecoming when you'd go every year. You probably realize that because you're from Alaska, so you know. A little bit different down here than Alaska, but everybody was so friendly, and it's just kind of like a big family type thing. So anyway, that's kind of what you look back at. Working in the canneries and stuff.
What sort of annual traditions did you have up there?
Fourth of July. They always celebrated Fourth of July with everybody, had a big picnic. And I think that basically would be, that'd be the only holiday, I think, wouldn't it?
Was it volleyball?
Oh, they used to have, oh yeah, they went, they have a tournament, didn't they?
Yeah.
Volleyball tournament, that was a big thing, and then
took
they'd have
the whole warehouse over, whatever.
Yeah, and they'd have a big picnic after that, you know, so that was kind of a nice thing. Of course, the kids were all that age, you know, they just all really liked that volleyball, so. Yeah.
That was the day off, just get out of the way.
Yeah, I was going to say that, that was the day, yeah, you didn't have to work. You looked forward to it. Dear.
When was the volleyball tournament?
Oh, gosh.
Was it before fishing started, end of the...
No, I think it was during the season.
It was during the season.
It was during the... Maybe during the closure. Yeah, you know, the closures. Yeah. So
maybe 2 or 3 days, it wouldn't be fishing.
Yeah. And so that would probably be when it was done, you know, so...
They closed the rivers.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that there are questions that I did not even think to ask. Is there anything else that you think is important to share?
I don't think so. That pretty much covers all of it, I think.
Basically, we rubbed it, I think, pretty well.
I think Bob covered it pretty well. Being in the position that he was, he knew everything that was going on.
It was a great job. Untouchable, what you'd call it.
Yeah, I think he liked that job.
My first job, I was there, and the fellow who was the beach boss and all that, you know, did all the dock work and all the, and we had breakfast. And this fellow, the beach boss, looks at me, "This is not going to be easy for you, guy. You'll see that we're not going to be very cooperative." Well, the superintendent was sitting at the end of the table, and he says, "Just a minute, fella. I got news for you. He'll be here 30 years after you're gone. Let's stop right there." That ended the whole thing from then on.
And you were there for...
Yes. I felt like crawling on the table.
And who was the superintendent?
Norman Rockness, my favorite. He was my kind of people.
Yeah, he was very nice. He ended up dying of cancer, so he He was only there two years when I was there, so yeah.
And then who followed him?
Tom Takioka.
Tom Takioka, and then Gary.
Yeah, and then Gary was the assistant under Tom, and then Gary was the next year after Tom, so yeah.
Gary was treated me like royalty too.
Yeah, Gary was a nice superintendent. Yeah.
And when you retired, was he still superintendent?
He was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was superintendent. I think he was about a year after we left. Yeah.
It got pretty tough right there, changing people and different people trying to do things that, like I mentioned, that they wanted to change this and that and that and that. You can't change the whole system in a season. It'll shut down on you.
You don't have time, you know. Everything is so fast and furious.
Just glad I wasn't there.
Yeah. So I don't know.
No mention any names, it's just the way it kind of held with the group, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Well, thank you both so much for your time and sharing all of this with me.
Well, it's been very nice.
I hope it had some fruit
with
to it.
I think so.
Yeah, I hope it had some.
I think so.
Yeah.